Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston. The Institute of Physics is the professional body and learned society for physics in the UK and Ireland. It represents 21,000 members, and a key goal of the Institute is to make physics accessible to people from all backgrounds. The IOP's current president is Sir Keith Burnett, who is halfway through his two-year term in office, knighted in 2013 for his services to science and higher education. Sir Keith has served as Vice Chancellor of the University of Sheffield and is also an advocate for high-quality vocational education and technician training. Here he is in a wide-ranging conversation with Physics World's Mateen Durrani.
Hello, everyone. This week on the Physics World podcast, we've got a very special guest, Professor Sir Keith Burnett, President of the Institute of Physics, which, of course, publishes Physics World. Now, Keith is an atomic physicist by training who spent about 20 years at the University of Oxford, and then he became Vice Chancellor of the University of Sheffield, a position he held till 2018. And he's also got fingers in a scheme to mentor students. We'll come back to that. But hello, Keith. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Mateen.
So for people who don't know you, that sounds like you're a very, very important and big cheese in the world of physics. But let's just say your background is perhaps fairly, dare I say, quite ordinary. So where did you grow up? You're originally from Wales, aren't you?
Yeah, I grew up in the mining valley in South Wales, Rhondda Valley, you know, and that was a wonderful place. I grew up in a real wonderful, cohesive mining community when I was little. So, no, I had a great time. And I met my wife when we were eight, got married when I was 21. You know, I'm a Welsh boy, you know.
So what sparked your interest in physics? Did you have a particular person, a teacher, or, you know, someone in your family who had a scientific interest?
I had all of the above. I think, first of all, I had a really wonderful time because it was the time that the Apollo space program was going. And that was, oh God, the excitement there was, because we were watching the missions going, you know, seeing the possibilities as it grew. So I was fascinated by the idea of space. That was one thing there. I did have then a wonderful teacher in school, Cook, Mr. Cook. And I also had an environment where, I suppose, my father worked for a small engineering company that made ceramics. And also it was the environment of materials and things like that. So I had a lot of great things. And I just loved the idea of science from the very beginning.
And then, of course, you became a researcher in atomic physics. So what was that field that particularly interested you? Again, did you have a particular mentor, or what sparked the interest in that?
Absolutely wonderful undergraduate lecturer and teacher. So I had, first of all, Welshman again started me off in physics teaching me, but a wonderful laser physicist, Colin Webb, who actually started Oxford Lasers, we maybe know about it. He was an amazing undergraduate teacher at Jesus College, and he inspired me, and he sort of passed me on then to one of his sort of buddies, Derek Stacey, who was running the research group that was actually founded by Heini Kuhn, who was an emigre scholar in 1933 from Germany. Wonderful tradition of atomic physics and precision atomic physics. So great start in life.
So Colin Webb, you mentioned, he of course went off to found Oxford Lasers. Did the sort of commercial side of things ever appeal, because then you became a, you know, an academic?
Not so much, but I did really admire what Colin was doing, because he was very early in terms of doing commercialization. He did it very much because people wanted the type of lasers he was making in the lab. He's making eczema lasers and people wanted them. And in fact, I was just got an email from him. He's in retirement, but he's very pleased that Oxford Lasers just has a good contract for doing semiconductor work. So they're doing going strong. So, but I very much admire that. There's a possibility of applications of lasers and optics, things of that sort.
And of course, you were around, you know, back in the 90s, I remember when, you know, the whole excitement about Bose-Einstein condensation and laser cooling and all that stuff, that was a real sort of peak period for atomic physics in some sense, wasn't it? And you saw many of the developments there.
Yeah, it was wonderful, because I was involved actually going back. I was on the search committee that hired Carl Wieman to Boulder. And so I was very much keeping a look on that, because I started in America, in Boulder, Colorado, and Carl joined the faculty and worked then with Eric Cornell to make a Bose-Einstein constant. And I was tracking that very, very closely. And it was an absolutely wonderful time, actually, because it went from no one thinks you can make it to, oh, maybe they've made it. You know, oh, wow, it's really big and juicy and we can do great stuff with it. You know, it was a absolutely wonderful time. Yeah.
Yeah. And I suppose worthy winners of the Nobel Prize, those particular people, weren't they? Because they won the prize in 2001.
Yeah, along with Wolfgang Ketterle. And yeah, I think it was a really remarkable, it has twists and turns in terms of how to do it, you know. So the person who developed the ideas behind the cooling goes back, big influence to Dan Kleppner at MIT. He actually, he's the person who developed how to do hydrogen cooling with Tom Greatak. And what they did, which is really important, is the people at MIT taught other people about how to do it. It's an example of when there were people at Stanford, at MIT, and Boulder, they were all working together to do it, you know, and because of that, they went much faster, you know, and were able to learn from one another. And it shows you, if you don't have trust and the ability to exchange ideas, everything slows down.
Mm. Yeah, that's an interesting point. And then, of course, after Oxford, you moved into sort of, dare I say, science administration policy circles, became vice chancellor at Sheffield University, which is, you know, very important UK university. So what attracted you to move into that kind of work?
Because I wasn't involved really in administration per se, so about 49, you know, and then they said, well, will you be head of physics at Oxford? And I thought, wow, yeah, that'll be amazing. So I did, and it was very perplexing, but wonderful, because amazing department. And then quickly, I was a year or so as head of division at Oxford, and then I became vice chancellor. But the person who inspired me was actually an ex-president of the Institute of Physics and the previous vice chancellor of Sheffield, Gareth Roberts. So Gareth was actually, again, Welshman. North Wales, very different from South Wales, you know, but still played soccer, not rugby, you know. But Gareth actually was, we worked together partly at Oxford, and he said, you should really think about it. And I think what he saw is my own background as, you know, steel and mining. I'd go to a town that was bathed in, you know, traditions of making steel and processes and metallurgy and things of that sort. And I would love being both part of the civic life of the city, which I did. I'm very proud of it as a city, but also just feeling, yeah, this is a university that does wonderful things for its citizens, its students, and around. The other thing that happened is my daughter had gone to Sheffield before me. So she's an architect in Sheffield. So I always say I follow my daughter's footsteps.
That's very good. So you said you were a rugby player.
Very poor rugby player, but yes. Well, you had to, right? You're from where I was from. You know, you didn't have an option. The famous Burnett in the Burnett family, though, the very famous Burnett, is not a rugby player, he's a darts player. My cousin Richie was world darts champion in 95. So,
oh, really?
He's the well-known Burnett in the valley, not me.
Okay, brilliant story, yeah. Are you any good at the darts?
Terrible.
And then, of course, you know, one thing, Keith, you talked to when last time we met in the IIP publishing offices in Bristol, that we talked about the fact that universities in the UK are very successful, but in a sense, universities like Sheffield and others are essentially, you could call them big businesses because they have huge turnovers and they rely a lot on their income from foreign students in particular to keep them afloat, who pay higher fees than home students.
That's right.
Obviously, those students bring a lot of benefits to a country like the UK, and the same is probably true in other countries. The influx of talented students from abroad obviously brings big benefits to universities.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, first of all, yeah, you have to acknowledge that the expansion of higher education is a considerable thing, right? So when I left Sheffield, we had nearly 8,000 staff. You know, I mean, that is a big organization, turnover of 500 million, capital program of 500 million. So you have to feel comfortable with the idea that you are helping that sort of organization. And it does take different skills, right? I mean, I was lucky. I was pretty well trained up by John Hood here at Oxford in terms of the financial part of it. But there is a genuine problem in that when you have a large university, how do you relate then this large business to the individual excitement of academia? You know, how do you actually still say, no, this is a place where we want to teach and help people in that way? And then, as you say, Martin, the big thing that happened to you in Durham is the the change to student fees. So first of all, I oppose the introduction of tuition fees, which wasn't very popular amongst many of my vice chancellor colleagues. And I remember being pressured by number 10 actually to sign a letter with other Russell Group to support it going through. I was very much against it because I thought it would fundamentally change the relationship with students. I understood the needs, I understood it, but I thought it was a very bad move to change that relationship. We're already charging the bitter fees to go up in that way to mean that there was going to be a major burden on households. I just disagree. I still disagree with it. And it hasn't been very efficient also. If you look at it, at the time, Hefke was giving universities about 5 billion in teaching, roughly. Now they're shoving out 18 billion in student grants, which they have to write off 12 billion. So now we have a situation where the country's got a very bad investment portfolio and the students got debt as well. So I think it's been pretty fair to say it's a disaster. So what we've done is then the other thing, I'm sorry I'm taking so long, but these matter to me enormously, is that then we haven't been able to change the undergraduate fees then for over 10 years. So what I see now is then universities where international student fees were a top up. You know, when I was at Sheffield, we were able to use international student fees to build a new engineering teaching lab, you know, the Diamond. Nowadays, they're pretty much built into the fabric. In other words, without international student fees, you can't run the university now. And I mean, in one sense, it's wonderful, which I can credit, just as you were saying, Martine, it's a wonderfully powerful thing to happen. But it's too much pressure now on things to subsidize, you know? And when I've been going around physics departments, so I've been at Newcastle and we were at Bristol, you know, just this week. And, you know, that now I see the most extraordinary opportunities of physics to deliver to modern society. You know, I mean, if you look at the Institute of Physics, I mean, the council would be extremely negligent if I didn't mention the new Institute of Physics strategy, you know, but it's a beautiful one because what it says is we're training people for skills. They do science, they influence society. I saw Bristol, for example, amazing physics department, you know, and what they've done in terms of the link to quantum physics in particular. But through not just physics, engineering, business, the whole damn thing. But the font of that, you know, the tap that feeds it is actually undergraduate physicists. And we're making it by the fact now we're making it much harder for physics departments to exist. And what we're doing, pushing universities to need to have to cross-subsidize. And where does that subsidy come from? International students. So now we've got a pretty tough situation for both, you know, physics department heads and universities to run. And actually, I think if we don't, you know, as a country say, no, we need more physicists and going to have to fund it more directly, not just rely on international student transfer, we'll miss the opportunities. You know, we're still going to have vital physics departments. But my God, the stuff that's going on at the moment in physics, you know, I almost would like to take sort of citizens around and say, please, we'd have a look at what my physics colleagues are doing. You'd want to give them a bit more to keep going. Yeah, anyway, I'll stop. People complain sometimes I sound like a preacher from the valleys.
But there's also that wider political concern that when you do have so many students coming, you obviously they perhaps bring spouses and families, and you've got a rise in immigration, and you have to tap into that whole angst about what are the high levels of immigration. And then, of course, there's the other problem that if you do rely on students from certain countries, you could have political instabilities. And suddenly, if, you know, let's say China puts barriers up to them, if their students going abroad, or we introduce barriers, then, you know, suddenly you could have universities in a real deep, deep trouble.
What's happened, you're absolutely right, Martine. I mean, first of all, your first point, yes, it is then an issue to do with immigration in the country. And the discussion tends not to be, well, I won't dismiss saying it's irrational. It tends to quickly go to some of the worst aspects of you can hear in society, right? Fundamentally, if you look at a place like Sheffield, the balance is enormously in terms of input of vitality, money, inward investment, things of that sort. But I understand others may say, no, we don't like it, you know, taking accommodation, things of that sort. But it's difficult to get a balanced discussion. My discussion with people and experts in immigration is that it's far more neutral than people think. You know, in other words, it doesn't gigantically change either direction, but it is very inflammatory. What you can see this year, for example, it was in the Financial Times, I think midweek, a 37% decrease in postgraduate student applications to British universities. Now, you know, whether you like or not, that has been a very big aspect of cross-subsidy from areas that do it. Basically, usually the business schools, I mean, the people who are coming in into international relations. Engineering, quite popular. Not so many international students in Physics Direct, but they are supported by, you know, the side business school at Oxford is supporting the physics department at Oxford, right? And yeah, you're right, Martin. We've got a bit of, it's difficult at the moment to get a balanced discussion of what's the real advantage in terms of that? What are the disadvantages? It tends to run quickly. But I do say that the danger is to cut off a stream of cross-subsidy without putting in place good things. You would expect me to say that, but honestly, it is true. If you know this, and Physics World is wonderful at showing the incredible development. Just at Bristol, for example, the number of companies now that are working with Bristol University in terms of its quantum tech. You know, we had Sir Peter Knight talk to us there about how things were going. This is big potential business long-term, but it relies on physicists. Physics departments that are under strain in terms. Universities that want to subsidize but are finding it tougher. You know, I honestly did think this would be the problem. Going back, I remember talking to even the Labour government, previous Labour government. The concern I had is higher education is not just for the individual. You know, it has consequences for society more generally and for business. And if you say, no, it's just to do with an individual choice, just whether someone goes to university and pays a fee, it can work to a certain extent, but it's obviously the case you will not have the scientists you need. I mean, at the moment, I hope people are thinking and realizing that many of the people we trained as physicists are now working in industries to defend the country. I mean, it's come up the agenda again, right? But, you know, and you may dislike it or like it in terms of the involvement of physics in technologies that involve defense, but blimey, it's a big, important thing at the moment.
But if you didn't rely so much on foreign student fees, who else would fund those universities? And that's the, where would that money come from? I suppose is the question.
It is. And in fact, what's the issue? If you look at it, what I would say is that you have to decide what the benefit is to society as a whole. If you say, as we've done now, the only benefit is to individuals, it then turns out, in fact, that you, when you look at it, well, my God, we're going to have to subsidize. We're going to have a loan book, actually, which write off. I think it's been a bad decision financially for the UK. I think it'd been better to think in advance, you know, as we did. Remember, we had a Higher Education Funding Council that roughly balanced the system in terms of numbers, where people went. Now it's a free-for-all in terms of choice. And some of it's good, but some of it, I think it's bad. Actually, as a country, we need more people in STEM. How are you going to enhance that? Well, I was advocating from the beginning, please don't just have the same fees to do everything. If the country wants people to do things, you should think about how to enhance that. You know, it does make sense. And so I just think we haven't had a discussion about what the benefit in public individual value. And I think that's something we need to go back to. What's higher education for? I can see from the point of view of someone who sees physicists going into industry, going to technology, going to study the universe. But I think just saying, well, we'll just do it as a market system and that will balance out the benefits for individuals and society is just false. I'd use more firm and strong words if I didn't think this was a decent way of talking to people. But I mean, you know, I think it's just, as you can imagine, what I'd say.
And we mentioned at the start, Keith, about the Schmidt Science Fellows. Now, for people who don't know what that is, could you briefly explain it?
Oh, it's a really wonderful thing. So it is an idea. Stu Feldman, who's sort of friendly, long-term confidant of Eric Schmidt, you know, who was the chief executive and chair of Google. And he said there ought to be a way in which people, once they've done their PhDs, can think more broadly than just carrying on in a particular thing. How can we identify a group of people across the world who've got fantastic ideas and then give them some freedom to move? And so that started off 6 years ago now. where it's based at Roast House. We select people from across the world. I don't do the selection, somebody else does. And then we ask them, where do they want to go to? What do they want to do? And then we help them choose if they have an exciting idea where they might go in the world. A lot go to the US, you know, but we also have across Europe and UK. And then actually the great thing they said was, well, we want somebody who mentors them in making this transition and mentors them in the new environment. And that was my job initially. Initially, I did all of the mentoring. Now I have some other colleagues. But I now have about 120 people across the world in different institutions, now moving on, national labs, academia, companies, startups, that I have this network I talk to. And so we had a big jamboree, met them all in Chicago last November. And it's the most wonderful job, because it means I get to hear what are the issues that early career scientists have. What are the difficulties they have making transitions in working in interdisciplinary environments? All those things. So I'm a sort of chock full of perceptions, ideas. It's also kept me, I hope to say, but younger in the sense, because what we've been riding, particularly in the last 5 years, is the enormous growth in the use, for example, of AI and machine learning. So a lot of my fellows are actually really plugged into the cutting edge of how do you use machine learning in all sorts of things, imaging, biomolecules, precision drugs, everything. So it's also given me a perspective on development. So it's a fantastic time and job.
What sort of mentoring does it mean on a practical level, on a day-to-day? Is it just talking to them or helping them with grant applications, or what does it involve?
And jobs, anything. So actually it will be all the way from, I've got an issue with the financial system in the lab. How could I deal with it? Or the PI is, how can I explain to them what I want to do? To this is my research statement I got for a faculty application, or this is where I'm thinking of doing. So it's given me a very broad range of perspectives on what it is to be an early career researcher, trying to do interesting things across the world. And there I see my concern as a UK person as well, is that, first of all, comparisons in terms of what people expect, you know, in the UK compared to other places. Starting out, of course, with salaries, you know, that's probably our first most serious starting point, is how much we're able to pay early careers. Scientists in particular, I think we're in grave danger, in fact, of underpaying our early career scientists in the, well, not danger, we are comparatively, you know, and that's the first thing. And also the other conditions associated with it. The other thing that I've had is a lot of experience of a scheme which is roughly gender balanced. It's slightly more female than male. And so actually I've had a lot of experience of the issues of making transitions through family events, you know, and one of the things the Schmidt program does is have very generous maternity and paternity leave. And so I've had one of our fellows has had two children while on the scheme. And we know that actually making a scheme that's extremely family friendly is good. And what we're trying to do, this is Megan Ken is the executive head, you know, work. She, with the team there, is working on how do we get other institutions to think about these issues, particularly about the interdisciplinary ones. So we're working with Times Higher in terms of how do we look at what institutions are really good at taking the interdisciplinary ideas of fellows or faculty and promoting them. So it's been the most wonderful thing. You know, it's... I can recommend it.
And then, obviously, in October 2023, you started your two-year stint as president of the Institute of Physics. So what are your priorities during your 2 years in office?
Well, I was very lucky in the sense that Tom Grinney had come on board and we worked together. I was vice president with Sheila Rowan doing it, but together we worked with the council to have a new strategy, and it's sort of slimmed down and purposeful, I think that's what I would say, because we realized that, first of all, the it's the skill base of the teachers and researchers that's absolutely critical. So our first focus is, are we helping teachers enough? You know, are we helping the people who help people get into physics enough? So that's the first big, and it's a big focus for me. I feel the pipeline of talent into not just the profession, but all aspects of awareness of physical science. I mean, it's not just professional physicists who work in academia things. It's the way in which someone trained as a physicist as undergraduate may take it into finance industry, may take it into more general policy things. So, but it's teachers, first of all, so that's the first thing, and that's the skills base. Then we are very interested in influencing key aspects of science. So we had a launch of our Physics World covers these things wonderfully. You know, for example, the green technologies, physics technologies into a green economy. And that to me is one of the important ways in which we have to explain that it's usually physicists with engineers and chemists together that do important technology. But, you know, the physics core is big in terms of how we make an impact on climate change issues. So, again, and we've got a really good team inside the IOP looking at how we make sure that people understand that the science that our broad community in broad sense is doing is represented to industry, government, things of that sort. So, you know, first of all, skills, get them, make sure we're explaining the nature of science that can be done. And then the other thing is make sure that the impact's coming out in that way. So teachers, you know, we're very interested then in, and we're developing how we help university teachers as well, not just that. We are thinking more about how do we in fact make membership of the IUP more generally useful and accessible. I suppose it's I don't think it's just arrogance to think that someone reading Physics World with an awareness and background in physics is just that much better prepared for lots of things that are going on in the modern world. I think it's true. You know, so many aspects of the changes that happen in terms of technology in people's lives. So I think that's where we're also really thinking, how do we get a slightly broader reach in our membership as well? And that's so. But we've got a wonderful bunch of trustees, actually. We had a meeting in Bristol. Very broadly based, you know, from people involved in industry, teaching per se, universities, non-universities, things of that sort. So we're going to have a go.
And a lot of those things you just mentioned there reflected in the new IOP strategy, which has just come out.
Yep. And that's what I hope that what we're trying to do is align it pretty strongly so people will see us boosting the nature of skills in society. You know, they'll see us representing the exciting opportunities of science going forward. They'll see us saying, where will those impact on society? That's what we want to make sure happens.
Oh, and how can members of the IOP get involved with the kind of helping put that strategy into practice?
So I think first of all, if you get a chance to look at it, that'd be a really good idea. we've very, of course, got then groups and nations. And that's the first place if someone is a member of a particular group or nation, seeing how that is working for them in that environment and feeding that back to their representatives, that would be really great. And then we actually will be reaching out to various parts of the membership as well. Because what you said is very important. We realize that our influence as an institute is much more powerful if we're actually the conveners and coordinators of a more general effort. We can't do all the things, but our membership is big and strong. So one of the things we're thinking about, how do we broaden the capability of the institute to do those things? So, okay, so as you said, what would you do? First of all, look at the strategy. Look at whether you're in, if you're not a member of the Institute of Physics and you're listening to this podcast and you're interested in physics, why not join?
We'd love to. Good advert, yeah. I like it, Keith.
We would really
subliminal
love
messaging, very good.
It's true. And then and also then feedback, you know, to your representatives, or if you can't find somebody, to me, you know, what do you reckon?
Brilliant. And before we end, Keith, you've talked in the past quite a bit about the need for the physics community to be more inclusive. So how do you see physics evolving over the next few decades?
I think it's very important on all levels. I think when people talk about, there's a wonderful book just came out by Ash Amin, who's a trustee of the Nuffield Foundation that I chair. And it was about really what he was talking about, how society is not evolving a direction of pluralism. You know, that many of the things that I think of as being important in terms of a just, equitable and diverse society are not being advocated, right? So what you get is you're getting a lot of parts of society sort of slightly backing off and backing away from these issues. At the same time, I think that a younger generation, I am experienced with the Schmidt fellows, for example, is utterly committed to a future society that's more just, equitable, and diverse. In other words, it is because they've grown up really freer of prejudice, but also discussing these things more openly, you know, much not interested in many of the divisions that people would see in terms of labels of any sort, you know. Any labeling of people due to race, ethnicity, sexual proclivity, anything at all is an anathema. And I personally find that inspirational. I really find inspiring, and I think one of the things that the Institute can do is actually say, well, what are the advantages of a society of that sort? First of all, it is the case that people growing up in free of it want it. They want a society of that sort. So they look at the Institute and say, we hope you're going to be that sort of society, right? They maybe someone look in and say, we're just a bunch of woke liberals, that's fair enough, but we're not actually. We're actually a bunch of people very interested in justice and equity in society. That's the first thing I would say. And then the other thing would be, you're going to have to work for it. Because actually, we are very far as a profession from that. We have great deficits in terms of our inclusion people. But, so how do we work on it? And I think going forward, I think we will have, you know, a younger generation coming through who will care much less about these issues in a sense, you know, because actually they won't see them. But actually we'll find it very strange that we didn't have a society and a physics community that just was represented as society as a whole. But to do it at the moment, I think the duty of my duty is to actually say, what are the advantages? The advantages, I think, are very, very powerful. First of all, not just in terms of equity and inclusion, you're just smarter, you know? If you exclude groups of people because of the labels you attribute to them, you're just deleting people who could be powerful and influential in and helpful in your society. You're just wasting people, you know? So I have this absolute commitment that the broader we are in terms of our capture of people into the community, the better we will be, the more just we will be, and the more powerful we'll be. And I think people, our community wants that. Some won't. Some will say, you know, this, no, I want a tradition. I've got a more traditional view of what society is, my perception of it. But I really think that it's our duty in sense to say why we want a more just and equitable society, because it's actually smarter, more powerful, more fun, right?
Yeah, I hope it's something a lot of people can agree with, because it just sounds, you know, very, very sensible and, you know, the right thing to do. So let's
go.
So
for
you're optimistic for the future. That's brilliant. Final note. Thank you, Keith. And lovely to have you on the Physics World podcast. And any final words before we go?
No, well, I just want to say, you might know, Physics World is a hell of a journal. It's a wonderful thing. And it's marvelous that we have that. Explaining physics and do things of that sort. It's a wonderful thing, Martine. So all I wanted to add is congratulations to you and your staff for doing such a fantastic job.
I'll keep that bit in the podcast. I'll let my boss know. Thank you, Keith, and thanks very much for being on.
Bye now.
That was IOP President Keith Burnett in conversation with Martine Durrani. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this week's podcast. Thanks to Keith and Mateen for joining me today. And a special thanks to our producer, Fred Isles. We'll be back again next week. But in the meantime, do check out the latest episode of the Physics World Stories podcast. Host Andrew Glester looks at theories of modified gravity, which seek to explain the large-scale structure of the universe without the need for dark matter. His guests are modified gravity advocate Stacy McGaw of Case Western Reserve University in the U.S. and the dark matter enthusiast Indranil Banik, who is at the U.K.'s University of St. Andrews. That episode is called Dark Matter versus Modified Gravity, Which Team Are You On? And you can find it on the Physics World website or at your favorite podcast provider.
Physics World.